Morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Happy Friday! And to help you celebrate, today I have a brand new show for you, which has just come out from under the 60-day embargo period during which our participating newspapers have exclusive rights. So thanks for joining me, and I hope you enjoy the show. This story was first published on July 6th of 2025 under the headline, The Legendary Lost Gold of Neocony Mountain. Here we go. Oregon is a state with more than its share of buried treasure legends. But the one that gets the most attention, and until fairly recently attracted by far the most treasure hunters, is the lost Spanish gold of Neocony Mountain. Like most buried treasure stories, it's a near certainty that nothing is there. But unlike most treasure stories, it seems likely that something real once was. The story of the lost Spanish gold has been passed down and around through natives and fur traders and later augmented by professional storytellers for maximum drama at Ben Holiday's Seaside House Resort. It's even been riffed on, sort of, to create one of the most beloved blockbuster movies of all time. I am, of course, referring to The Goonies. Today, there really isn't an official version of the story, but this is as close as I can come to summarizing the most common version. Sometime in the 1700s, a sailing ship put into Nehalem Bay. Most versions of the story have the ship dropping anchor there and sending a crew ashore in a rowboat. Others say the ship was wrecked, but these are most likely getting it confused with the beeswax wreck of the San Cristo de Burgos at the same location in the mid-1690s. The ship we're interested in today can't have been the beeswax ship, because there would have been no native witnesses left to pass down this legend. All those coastal communities were wiped out in the Cascadia subduction tsunami of 1700. The men then beached their rowboat and walked straight inland, up onto the side of Neocony Mountain, carrying a heavy chest. All this time, curious local native watchers followed their progress, wondering what they were up to. When they got partway up the mountain, they set the chest down and set to digging. After they got a nice deep hole, they lowered the chest into it. Then, apparently knowing the Indians would not disturb a man's grave, one of the men drew his cutlass and plunged it into one of the others. In some versions of the story, the men drew straws to see who would die. In others, the dead man was an enslaved black servant. Both versions are probably apocryphal. This isn't the kind of detail that would be remembered after three or four generations of native oral telling and retelling. In any case, this unfortunate man's body was then thrown into the pit on top of the chest, and the men then filled it back in. Man and chest were buried together, and this is actually the only part of the story that all versions agree on. After that, one version says the men rowed back to the ship and sailed off like it was just another day's work. Another version claims several sailors were left behind but soon made themselves obnoxious to the native men by moving in on the local women and got killed in the ensuing fights. Possibly the least plausible version is the one in which the captain of the ship goes on a murdering spree, killing all his crew members except those who can fit in a lifeboat and then setting out on the open sea in that, rowing to California. Okay, sure. Tell me you're not a sailor without telling me you're not a sailor, right? So time passed. The story of the buried treasure was passed down from parents to children in the local Indian communities for generations. And then, starting around 1810, British and American expeditions of fur traders began to arrive in the Oregon country. First the Astorian Party, then the Hudson's Bay Company, and later Nathaniel Wyeth's crew, along with several other smaller fur trading outfits. All of them wanted to trade with Indians for otter furs, so they immediately set out talking with them. And soon, of course, the story of the weird bearded murderers in the winged canoe burying a box and corpse on Neocony Mountain came up. Neocony Mountain hasn't been left alone since. Of course, if the treasure was real, nobody wanted to share it, so most expeditions were made as secretly as possible. This was obviously easier to do earlier when the area was less populated. One visitor after another tried his luck digging hopeful holes in the side of that mountain in quest of the Spanish gold. People have spent years, decades, whole lifetimes doing this. In the 1870s, treasure hunter Pat Smith found some stones marked with arrows and crosses and letters, but nobody could figure out what, if anything, they meant. The best guess is currently that they were part of a survey made by either Sir Francis Drake or one of the several Spanish galleon captains that might have put into the bay. Of course, as the population increased toward the end of the 1800s and the beginning of the 1900s, interest in the treasure story grew and word spread. In the early 1870s, stagecoach King Ben Holiday built the spectacular Seaside House Resort Hotel in what would later be the town of Seaside, and hired native storytellers to entertain his guests. These storytellers, of course, milked the Spanish gold story for all they could. In 1907, another wealthy inlander, Samuel G. Reed of Portland, tried to run the Seaside House play on a smaller scale at the foot of Neocony Mountain. He called his hotel the Neocony Tavern, and found it considerably harder to keep his hotel booked with guests than Holiday had, so he resorted to promoting the place to prospective treasure hunters, even providing guests with picks and shovels. In 1931, the mountain drew first blood when father-son treasure hunting team Charles and Lynn Wood dug a hole 30 feet into the mountain without timbering it. Of course, it collapsed, burying both men alive. One other treasure hunter was drowned in 1990 looking for treasure on the rocky rim using an inflatable rubber raft to scout from the water, which really doesn't seem like a very good idea. And evidently it wasn't, because the guy drowned. When power equipment became available, things really started to get serious. Treasure hunters brought bulldozers and backhoes and heavy equipment out onto the beach and up onto the side of the mountain, most of which was now part of Oswald West State Park. As the treasure story's fame grew, crackpots started coming to the scene with dowsing rods and marked-up Bibles that they claimed predicted the treasure's location. One convinced himself, and never stopped trying to convince others, that the Ark of the Covenant was buried there. Meanwhile, by the late 1960s, the state of Oregon was getting worried about environmental damage and potential impacts on other park visitors who didn't come to the beach to play around bulldozers and open pits. Clearly, some control was needed. So in 1967, the state passed the Treasure Trove Law to allow people to dig for treasure on public land if they applied for a permit first. Unfortunately, the law didn't define a treasure trove, so it basically turned treasure trove permits into licenses similar to a mining claim that allowed a treasure hunter to dig for almost anything while keeping other park visitors out. Even worse, the law claimed half of whatever a treasure hunter found for the state. This, of course, made the state look like it was just another claim jumper horning in, calling dibs from the sidelines in hopes of reaping where it had not sown. Essentially, the state lost the moral high ground, and when state agencies tried to limit what treasure hunters could do, they reacted as if the state were an untrustworthy business partner reneging on their deal. But the law really was unworkable, especially as it became increasingly clear to academics and state agencies alike that giving treasure hunters carte blanche to loot Indian burial sites and other archaeologically important places in the name of hunting for a treasure trove was just a really bad idea. To make matters worse, the more serious treasure hunters, the ones with ditch witches and backhoes and bulldozers, tended to have aggressive and entitled attitudes about their supposed rights. They behaved like gold miners responding to claim jumpers. It became very clear that many, possibly most of them, did not consider the state to have any moral authority to interfere with their operations, and would only follow the law when forced to do so by constant enforcement. But these latter-day treasure hunters may be barking up an empty tree anyway. There is some reason to believe the treasure was real but was found long ago. This evidence is anecdotal and very circumstantial, but it's there. It seems that back in 1811, a fur trapper named Thomas McKay, father of Indian scout Donald McKay of Oregon Indian Medicine Company fame, arrived in Astoria on the Astorian Party's ill-fated sailing ship Tonquin. According to the story related by Samuel Clark several years later, after the Hudson's Bay Company had bought out Astor's operations and taken over as McKay's employer, McKay was out trapping and trading one day when he met an old Indian woman who told him that she, as a little girl, had been one of those natives peeping through the bushes at the strange bearded Spaniards burying the booty. When he asked her to, she took him right to the spot and pointed it out. That's the story. A few weeks or months later, back at Hudson's Bay headquarters at Fort George, a rumor started getting around that McKay had found the by-now-famous Neocony treasure. How that cat got out of the bag is unclear. Maybe McKay was spending a suspicious amount of time on the mountain, or maybe the same source that told Samuel Clark about the situation also told somebody else.
He must have dug for it, as the Hudson's Bay Company people heard that he did so, so sent for him and placed him under rigid examination, Clark writes. It seems that the company claimed that all their people discovered or found when in their service was the company's property. Tom couldn't be blamed if he did not think so.
After that, one day, Tom walked away from the mountain, quit his job, and disappeared. Years later, when he settled at French Prairie by the Willamette River, he seemed oddly flush with cash for those pre-California gold rush years.
He was a generous fellow and always had money to spend and to give away, Clark writes, so much so that when he afterwards settled on French Prairie, he lived so well and was so liberal to all in need that people believed that he surely had found that treasure and gloried that he made such good use of it.
And again, remember, this was before the 1848 gold rush, when other residents of the Willamette Valley were using bushels of wheat and Abernethy rocks as currency. Could it be that Thomas McKay found that chest, secretly slipped away with it, quit his job, and went somewhere else to enjoy it? Free from the notoriety and envy that always seemed to accompany found money? Actually, isn't that what any one of us would do? Key sources in this story included works by Cameron La Follette and Samuel Clark. That's our show for today. Thanks again for listening, and I do hope you enjoyed it. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show. Hey, if you like listening to me talking about interesting stuff, you should check out my new podcast that I've started this year. It comes out 3 times a week, and it's called the Penny Dreadful Hour Podcast, and basically we work our way through 6 different Penny Dreadful story papers from the 1840s and 50s and 60s. Sweeney Todd, the Barber of Fleet Street, Varney the Vampire, or the Feast of Blood, Black Bess, or the Night of the Road, starring highwayman Dick Turpin, The Black Band, or the Companions of Midnight, which is an international espionage thriller from 1861, and Rose Mortimer, or the Ballet Girl's Revenge, which I'm not quite sure what Rose Mortimer is, but it is a barn burner of a story. Check them out wherever you get your podcasts. I've really been enjoying doing the show and watching it grow, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. For more about them, atlasstringband.com. Offbeat Oregon History episodes come out once per weekday, usually around 6 a.m. So it won't be long before the next episode is on your device and ready for you to queue up and enjoy. Until it is, go out there and fill up the rest of your day and the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.